Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. In Seoul, South Korea, Secretary of State John Kerry says the U.S. will defend itself and its allies from increasing threats from North Korea. Sentiment grows in the U.S. and internationally to do more to help the rebels in Syria and Margaret Thatcher's legacy. Joining me for the international hour of our Friday News Roundup, Tom Jilton of NPR, Indira Lakshmanan of Bloomberg News, and Mark Mardell of the BBC. You are always welcome. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Nice to see you all. Tom Jilton, Secretary of State Kerry, is in South Korea today. What is his message to the North?
His message to the North is to warn the Kim Jong-un and the rest of the North Korean leadership to back off on all this belligerent talk and to don't dream for a moment that you can gain any kind of military advantage by doing something provocative, by launching a missile in the direction of U.S. or Japanese territory, or by doing something to the South Koreans. He said specifically, if you get into a war with the United States, you're going to lose.
And what about this intelligence report that became public yesterday, Indira?
Well, let's keep in mind that was a Defense Intelligence Agency report, which it was one line of the report that became public, one line only, which a congressman who read from it in a hearing, said was the only declassified line. And in it, he said that the Defense Intelligence Agency had determined that North Korea did have the capability to attach a miniaturized nuclear device onto a warhead. Now, there has been, since he made that statement, contradictions from others, such as the DNI, James Clapper, came out saying, well, this is not exactly what we think. It seems, we have intelligence sources who have told us privately that they also don't think the North is ready and capable of launching, of basically attaching a miniaturized nuclear device to a missile that could be launched somewhere. So there seems to be dispute within the U.S. intelligence community about this, but let's not, the main point is that all this belligerent talk is a problem. And as Kerry said, it would be a huge mistake for the North to act on any
Mark.
Of it.
I think one of the most intriguing things about this is a test for the Obama doctrine that says reach out, make alliances, not just with your natural friends, but those who are competitors and even enemies. And China is key to this. Kerry has said he wants to instill a sense of urgency in China. There is a great sense that they're getting fed up with their allies. Mao said that North Korea and China should be as close as lips and teeth, but they seem to have sort of bitten their lip here, I think, a little bit. And I thought that the most interesting thing I saw this week was an article in the People's Daily, a message from the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi, a message to four nations, US, Japan and the two Koreas. But he was saying to the North Korea, there's no reason to violate resolutions. The situation's development on the peninsula will not necessarily go according to the ideas and expectations of the DPRK. Pretty chilling for a message from China. They're not usually that open. So they're saying, cool it, calm it down.
You know, there was actually a prominent Communist Party official who editorialized in an official newspaper that China should abandon North Korea, and he was promptly suspended. Nevertheless, what I think is the bottom line is that China is allowing this debate to take place. That debate would not have been allowed in the past. And so, in a sense, what's significant there is not that these voices who are calling for the abandonment of North Korea are getting endorsed, but they are being allowed to make the argument.
And what about the meeting yesterday between Secretary General of the UN Ban Ki-moon and President Obama.
Right. Well, one of the main things that came out of that meeting, obviously they were talking about North Korea, no question, yeah. And Ban Ki-moon is a senior South Korean diplomat before he became UN Secretary General. One of the things that made the most news out of that meeting was, of course, what was said about Syria. So I'm sure we'll move on to that later. But I just wanted to make one point about China, which is that China is really North Korea's lifeline to the outside world. Any and all of the trade that North Korea has goes through China. But let's remember that China is having, as one analyst said to us, nuisance fatigue about North Korea. I mean, they have become such a pebble in the shoe of China that China was actually willing to co-sponsor the latest UN resolution with the sanctions against North Korea, co-sponsor it with the U.S. I mean, that is a first. And the fact is, China's exports to North Korea fell 13.8% in the first quarter of this year. That's significant. And also, China has 60 times the trade with South Korea that it has with North Korea. So, you know, if you're looking at the bottom line dollars and cents figure here, China has other fish to fry, not just its North Korean neighbor.
What about the Pentagon and its statements regarding whether the U.S. has what it takes to deal with North Korea, Tom?
The Pentagon has been, the whole Obama administration has been way more forthright in sort of displaying its military capabilities vis-a-vis North Korea than they have been in the past. I mean, we're in the middle, as you know, Diane, of this month-long military exercise that serves as an opportunity to display that military might. And this year, the United States has taken a step further. It has deployed for the first time ever a anti-missile defense system in Guam, or it is in the process of deploying. It's the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense. I think I've got that term right. It has been tested before, but it has never actually been put into operation. And so the United States, and in addition to that, we have more Patriot missiles going to Japan, and we, of course, have destroyers with anti-missile defenses in the ocean, and we have 14 new radar anti-missile interceptors being erected. So the United States is sending this message: if you think that you can launch missiles against us, we have the means to knock them down.
Another reason for China to do something, because they fear that the pivot to Asia is about America shoving in more military capabilities, getting the countries closer. And this is an ideal justification to do that. And, of course, it encourages Japan and other countries to be more friendly to America, saying, yes, have bases here, have your missiles here, as the Japanese have. So, again, China doesn't want that. If it wants a reason to get the United States out of the region, to calm things down, again, it just wants stability. Now, how it does that, as you were saying, that the economic pressure may well have some impact, but it's very difficult to know whether North Korea will take any notice.
So April 15 is not only the tax day in this country, it's significant for North Korea.
That's right. It is the 101st anniversary of the birth of Kim Il-sung, who's the grandfather of the current leader, the current dictator, Kim Jong-un, and, you know, his grandfather. What's significant is the North Koreans, or at least let's say the Kim dynasty, the third in the dynasty now, they love to celebrate these kinds of anniversaries. And, you know, essentially almost every year on various important anniversaries for the DPRK, as they call themselves, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, we've seen either ballistic tests, missile tests, nuclear tests. So there is concern, and the Pentagon has said that they are concerned, South Korea has said they are concerned, that there may be some sort of weapons test taking place either on the 15th or in the lead up to the 15th.
So is it a good idea for Secretary Kerry to be there as close to that as now?
I guess so. My guess is that North Koreans are now undecided about whether they want to hold off on that missile test until April 15th to commemorate the anniversary, or do they maybe want to pop it off while Kerry is there, which would give them another little propaganda boost. So, you know, I think that the visit of Kerry, more than anything else, reassures South Korea that the United States has its back.
And I think that one of the things that we have to remember, that there is a sense of calm in the region, and nobody I talk to here really thinks it's all going to blow up. And some people think that if they do launch a missile, well, it's provocation, but it gets it out of their system, that he's marched them up to the top of the hill and he can
but
say...
But suppose it lands in Japan.
Well, that's the problem. That is exactly
Japan
the problem.
Japan has deployed Patriot missile interceptors. And so that, you know, Japan is taking its own defensive action, not only relying on the fact that Japan and South Korea are treaty allies protected under the U.S. nuclear umbrella, but they're also taking their own actions. And this is a further concern we have to think about, which is as the North Korea continues these provocations, and not just provocations. I sort of hate that word because they're actually doing things. The more they do this, the more they stoke the possibility of an arms race or even a nuclear arms race in the region.
Or a bad miscalculation.
A bad miscalculation, but also the fact that we've got a majority of South Koreans for the first time now saying that they think South Korea should get a nuclear weapons program if North Korea keeps its own.
And the thing is that we saw some pretty serious provocations 3 years ago, and the South Korean reaction was not what the South Korean people thought was appropriate. And so the new government, you know, we talk always about this new government in the north with Kim Jong-un, but there's also a new government in the south that
is
now committed. Headed by a woman, President Park, and she is much more committed to an aggressive response, at least in, according to what she says, than the previous government. So to answer your question, if there is some kind of provocation similar to what we saw 3 years ago, it's likely that there'll be a much more aggressive response from the south, and that could set in cycle some kind of escalation.
Tom Gelton, NPR National Security Correspondent, Indira Lakshmanana, Bloomberg News, Mark Mardell of the BBC. Short break here. When we come back, we'll talk about Syria. Welcome back to the Foreign Policy Hour of our Friday News Roundup this week with Indira Lakshmanana, Bloomberg News, Mark Mardell of the BBC, and Tom Gelton of NPR. Let's talk about Syria. Mark, on Wednesday, the White House said it was moving to approve non-lethal aid to Syrian rebel groups, but there's growing pressure to provide more stuff.
Yes, and I think one has to be a little bit cynical about this. What they're talking about is night goggles and body armor, and they haven't made the announcement yet, have they, even though they hinted at it, as you say, a few days ago. And the Syrian opposition is saying, give us anti-aircraft guns, that's what we want. We, you know, night goggles probably all very nice, but they're not what they really want. There's talk in the European Union of lifting the arms embargo, and the British and the French are saying this must happen, but they've only got the support of Italy and Slovenia, which isn't enough for that to happen. So I think that things are moving very slowly. And I think with the other news this week that one of the main rebel groups fighting is taking the command of Al-Qaeda, which we'll talk about more. But with that, I can well understand the caution of the Obama administration, while a lot of people are saying, you know, just give them the stuff, let them finish it. Give who the stuff?
Well, you can argue this both ways. As Mark says, there is concern about who the rebels are and their close ties to Al-Qaeda, which have now been formalized in a bit. But you could also make the argument that as long as the rebels don't have sufficient weapons of their own, that they are forced to turn to those groups that are willing to provide them weapons, and those would be the jihadi-affiliated groups, the groups from outside Syria. So you can look at it either way. Do you want to give them some opportunity to be independent of those groups, or are you worrying about arming people that could come back to haunt you?
So, again, Secretary of State Kerry met with a Syrian opposition group in London. What happened there in Deraa?
Well, I mean, he obviously emphasized the point publicly that the U.S. has already given more than $115 million in non-lethal assistance to the rebels. And, you know, the White House, as we talked about, has, dangled the idea that they're going to give $10 million in additional non-lethal aid. Kerry seems to be trying to lean forward on this. Among all the people in the administration, he's leaning forward harder than the White House is on trying to support the rebels. And let's not forget, he was only just a few months ago the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, so it's very easy to look at his public record of his statements on this. And when he was still a senator just a few months ago, he was advocating military assistance to the rebels. So it's doubtful that his position has changed. Obviously, he has to hew to what the president wants, but I wouldn't be surprised if he's trying to exert his influence to help the rebels more than they have been helped. But I do think it's a difficult thing. Jabhat al-Nusra, this very effective fighting force that we talked about that's in the anti-Assad camp, has now outright said, yes, we're allied with Al-Qaeda, just like the U.S. Sanctioned them, declared them a terrorist group affiliated with Al-Qaeda some months ago. And, you know, so far the Syrian opposition, even though they've said we're not extremist, neither have they said Jabhat al-Nusra, stop fighting against Assad.
So what happens next? Do you see more lethal arms going to the Syrian opposition?
Yes, and I think the fighting is going to get worse. I mean, what would worry me is that this civil war is almost a prelude to another civil war between the Islamists and other parts of the opposition. And I think one of the things that intrigues me is that this is tremendously good news for Al-Qaeda, who, as President Obama has pointed out, time after time, has been degraded, has suffered defeat after defeat. And other groups tend to turn to them only when they're weakened and want that sort of boost. I'm not quite sure why Jabhat al-Nusra has turned to them now. Yeah. But it's for Al-Qaeda, it's a very important move. And just imagine if they did come to power in Syria, to have that as a new Afghanistan with those chemical weapons floating around.
You know, General James Clapper, the Director of National Intelligence, said something important yesterday in testimony on Capitol Hill. He said that even if Assad were to fall, that when Assad falls, if that's the case, that there would be as much as a year and a half of continued civil unrest in Syria. It would take at least a year and a half for a new government to be consolidated. So I think that goes to Mark's point. We're not just talking about a conflict that ends with the ouster of Bashar al-Assad. We're talking about a conflict that would continue beyond that point.
And Defense Secretary Hagel was also talking about chemical weapons.
Right. That has been from the start and remains a major concern of the Obama administration and a major reason, again, that the White House has hesitated to outright give military assistance to the rebels. And General Martin Dempsey, who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was also on Capitol Hill yesterday testifying. And he was asked by Bob Menendez, the new chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, you know, what are you prepared to do in Syria? And he said, interestingly, that the U.S. is prepared to take additional action if required, and that they are ready with options if military force is called for. Now, the way I interpret that is that, you know, the military has to say they're always ready for any eventuality, just like they say about Iran, no option is off the table. So I suppose their military planners have to have any option ready. But I don't think we should interpret that as saying that the White House is ready to take action, because they've clearly shown an allergic reaction to that so far.
And they don't want to get involved. But one wonders whether, I mean, Obama has said it's his red line if they cross it, if the government, Syrian government, uses it on the chemical weapons. But one wonders whether at some stage they have to do something about those chemical weapons, even if it's in a more peaceable environment going in to secure them, because they don't want them in the hands of any regime. They should be, by international law, destroyed. So I wonder what's going to happen if this goes on and on for ages and ages. Do they at some stage say, well, you've got to take them out of the equation?
Well, on the issue of taking out weapons, loose weapons, remember in the aftermath of the Libyan uprising and the overthrow of the Gaddafi government, the U.S. administration talked a lot about its concern about manpads, right? Shoulder-propelled missiles. And in the end, we didn't hear a lot about them rounding them up, and some of them ended up in Mali, and some of them ended up in Algeria and were used in the Al-Emanas gas field attack that resulted in all those hostages and deaths. So I don't know. I mean, we can have ambitions to take out, you know, weapons depots in other countries, but I don't know that we always succeed in doing so.
And now Russia is concerned about al-Qaeda's growing interest.
Well, yes, but the Russians can use that concern, which they know resonates in the West, as reason to say we need to be careful about abandoning the Assad government. I mean, there was pressure on Russia at this G8 meeting in London this week to line up with the other members of the Group of Eight in support of the rebels, and Russia refused to do it. Russia is still not ready to give up on the Assad regime, and as you say, they can use the appearance, the emergence, the strengthening of the al-Qaeda forces in Syria in order to buttress their argument.
Tom Gelton of NPR. And if you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. Mark Mardell, Jack Lew, the very, very important U.S. Treasury Secretary, has made his first official trip to Europe this week. He's talking about what?
He's talking about austerity and that it may not be a very good thing, that he's urging the Europeans to loosen their belts a little bit, spend a bit more money, and perhaps then they could buy American goods and that would help America, and wouldn't that be great? Interestingly, it got a lot of coverage in the American papers. It got virtually none in the British,
really?
And as far as I can see,
really?
European papers. It isn't new. I think that the Obama administration has clearly always been on the side of spending more money and not so keen on austerity, although everybody tries to balance it. There's a bit of a left-right argument here, the traditional Keynesian versus the sort of the let's deal with the deficit side. But I think it's aimed mainly at Germany, that there's an American frustration with Germany that they just won't loosen up, won't spend their money. And that's it's a very cultural thing. When I covered Europe, you go to Germany and a German company makes a massive profit, and the owner won't go out and buy a swimming pool and a yacht. He'll reinvest it sensibly and prudently in the company. And so it's very difficult to get the Germans to spend a bit more money.
But you can make the argument now that this is in Germany's own interest, because the German economy, which had been sort of the one bright spot in the Eurozone, itself contracted in the fourth quarter of 2012. So, you know, you can make the argument that Germany's obsession with fiscal discipline has actually contributed to its own economic stagnation.
Right. I mean, I read a piece in Der Spiegel, the main German weekly, online, that was headlined U.S. and Europe Deeply Divided in Austerity. And what I thought was interesting was the headline should have been, you know, Germany and Europe Deeply Divided on Austerity, because it's really not that all of Europe wants austerity. The French and the Italians have been trying to give the same message to Angela Merkel all along. And as Mark indicated, I mean, this really is something about the German I don't know, way of thinking. It's almost like, you know, I've heard Mario Monti, the outgoing Italian leader, saying that for Germans, economics is a moral science. Mm. And it's really about, even when the economy is booming, as Marx said, they are unwilling to loosen up and allow a little bit of inflation. And I've heard European leaders from other countries say to me, we just don't understand it. They're bringing down the Eurozone. Mm. And you hear some people even saying the Germans should leave the Eurozone and let the rest of us have the Eurozone. They can go back to the Deutschmark if they want to be this tough about
one,
it.
One of the other issues that Jack Lew raised was in regard to Cyprus, Tom. What's going on there?
Well, we haven't seen we were obsessed with the Cyprus story a couple of weeks ago, including here on this program, Diane, as you recall, and they sort of dodged a bullet. But what we now know is that the Cyprus economy is, I mean, it's hard to see any exit for Cyprus at this point, because they had counted on their financial sector to underpin their economy. And now what they have done with the haircuts is too mild a term. What they have done to the depositors in Cyprus banks will totally destroy any faith that outsiders have in Cyprus's financial system. So where does that leave that country? And the prospect now is that it is more likely that Cyprus will be the first country to leave the euro. And the fear then is that is like a domino. If Cyprus leaves, and it's a weak state, but if Cyprus leaves, who comes next?
And it was an astonishing move that it crushed the main economy, the main economic driver, the banks in Cyprus. It just got rid of their main industry. And I'm surprised that the fear of what happens to savings hasn't spread.
Mark Dale, the BBC, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Panama City, Florida. Good morning, Andrew. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I appreciate you taking my call, and I hope you have a great weekend.
Thank you.
It was pointed out earlier that China has orders of magnitude more trade with South Korea versus North Korea. And I wonder if the panel thinks that because of that they are being more pointed with North Korea than in previous times because of all the money that could be lost due to the lack of trade and the stock market dropping with all the rhetoric.
In era.
Well, I mean, I do think that, you know, China's bottom line is about growing their economy. And they do know that they have far more to gain from their relationships, both with South Korea and with Japan, than with North Korea. So, you know, there's no question that's factoring into their decision making.
All right. To Alexandria, Virginia. Good morning, Sam.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question to the panel is, with regards to Syria, what are they saying the actions should happen that would help the Syrian opposition? I mean, clearly what the States have done and the allies have undermined the opposition leadership in a way because we saw the emergence of extremist groups that are able to provide money and protection for the civilians, which is not the case for the opposition leadership. So what are they saying there should be done in the future to change that?
Tom.
Well, I assume, Sam, when you say they, you mean those who are arguing that our current policy is not right. I think the strongest argument is not necessarily to arm the rebels, but to provide them with defensive weapons, which is, as Mark said, what France and Britain have been arguing about, anti-aircraft weapons, anti-tank weapons. These are not offensive weapons, but they would improve the rebels' ability to withstand the kind of attacks that they have been subjected to repeatedly from the Assad forces. And as far as the jihadi groups that are so dominant in unfortunately in the opposition. This has actually created more of a split within the opposition forces, because there are powerful forces in the opposition. They don't necessarily have all the weapons, but they are numerically and politically more important, that do not like the emergence of this jihadi pro-Al Qaeda groups. And so they're making the argument, look, we need weapons so that we can distinguish ourselves from these jihadi groups that right now have a monopoly on the weapons.
Well, let's not forget that the UK and France, as we know, are pushing to lift this European arms embargo, but they're already supplying the rebels with military-style equipment such as anti-tank and anti-aircraft weapons. And I think that's interesting because, you know, for example, Human Rights Watch just came out with a report yesterday saying that Syrian Air Force pilots are basically carrying out war crimes. And they documented 59 unlawful air attacks by forces loyal to Bashar al-Assad on hospitals and bakeries and other civilian targets. So, you know, that bolsters the argument that the UK and France have for giving anti-tank and anti-aircraft weapons.
And something that my BBC colleague Gabriel Gatehouse has been able to confirm this week is that there is training by CIA and British intelligence in Jordan of rebel groups or of people, or at least that the commanders have given them an interview saying, yes, this is going on. Now, I don't know how much difference a small group being trained by the British and Americans would do, or exactly what they intend to do. But so there is activity going on behind the scenes, which we only glimpse occasionally.
Actually, that's right, and that training has been going on for a number of months already in Jordan. And unfortunately, as you say, there doesn't seem to be much of an impact on the ground from it.
Tom Shelton of NPR, Indira Lakshmanan of the Bloomberg News, and Mark Mardell of the BBC. Short break here, and more of your calls, your comments, when we come back.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. By the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. And by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. This is NPR.
Daniel Handler, a.k.a. Lemony Snicket, the author of the comic gothic novels A Series of Unfortunate Events, has a new children's book. On the next Fresh Air, Handler talks with us and plays a couple of Snicket songs on his accordion.
So I like to say that I'm one of the few people in the history of the world to take up the accordion basically in order to meet women.
Join us.
Welcome back. We'll go right back to the phones to Carol in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you, Diane. I think that the reaction to the DIA report seems overblown by the congressman as well as others. Didn't the report say that it had low to moderate confidence in its own conclusions? And therefore, shouldn't we sort of put that in some kind of perspective?
Tom.
It actually said moderate confidence, Carol, but you make a good argument that this may be too much attention has been paid to this. Couple points. First of all, I've covered the intelligence community, and you get debate and dissent within the intelligence community. That's part of the process, and this is one of the reasons they don't like their reports to become public, because they want to be able to, one agency wants to be able to go out on a limb and sort of provoke a debate, and then, you know, eventually you get a consensus. This was not a consensus. What the Director of National Intelligence last night said is that this does not represent the view of the entire intelligence community. Mm. And in fact, what I understand from speaking to intelligence officials is it was essentially a mistake that this became public, that that section of the report that was read by the congressman was erroneously declassified or erroneously not classified. Whoa. There was never an intent to have this be out in the public.
Indira.
Yeah, I think also part of what the caller may be thinking of is that there was moderate confidence in the finding, and the finding also said that the reliability of North Korea's missiles will be low. So that's where she may be getting that low from. But there's also domestic politics and pork barreling involved in all this, which is that Doug Lamborn, who's the Colorado Republican who made this public in a hearing, is seeking additional money for missile defense for his district, because his congressional district includes the North American Aerospace Defense Command, the U.S. Northern Command, Peterson Air Force Base, the U.S. Air Force Academy. So let's not forget, he also had his own political reasons for reading that sentence aloud.
And I think these guys are also the same ones who saw chemical weapons in Iraq. So we know that intelligence isn't absolutely 100%.
Well, now here's an email from Rose. Why don't Russia and the countries adjacent to Syria make a diplomatic effort to safeguard the chemical weapons now instead of waiting until the war is over?
Well, that's kind of an oxymoron, a diplomatic effort to safeguard chemical weapons. Chemical weapons can only be safeguarded by, you know, military forces is what I would say.
All right, to Orlando, Florida. Hi there, John. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question regarding Cyprus.
Sure.
And from a layperson's point of view, two questions. Number one, has stabilizing a banking agency or a bank in the United States, has it ever been contemplated here to capture depositor funds? And if not, is there any reason to think that, given this happening in Cyprus and with the instability in the European Union, that it might not ever be considered here in the United States?
Indira.
Well, we have the FDIC. So, you know, bank depositors' deposits in the United States are guaranteed up to a certain level. And that's obviously as a result of what happened during the Great Depression and the market crash in the United States. I mean, what was so frustrating and upsetting for Cypriot depositors is that there was basically an understanding, although Europe doesn't have its own FDIC, there was an understanding that ordinary depositors would have their deposits guaranteed up to around, I think it was 100,000 euros, and ultimately they had to come up with a new deal that wasn't going to affect, you know, the pensioners and the widow, you know, just living off that, and it was going to hit harder on the Russian money launderers who keep so much money in Cyprus. But I'm not sure that there is much concern about this having a knock-on effect on the United States. I think the knock-on effect people are worried about is depositors in Portugal or Spain or Italy or some of these other, you know, peripheral so-called Eurozone states who are having economic troubles. And if I were one of those depositors, I think I would be taking, I don't want to say this on the air, but I would be a little bit worried about my money in a national bank, about whether it could be seized in
exactly.
The future.
Exactly. All right. Let's talk about Margaret Thatcher. There has been lots of mixed news about her legacy since her death, Mark.
That's right. I mean, as a young or younger reporter, I covered her, the end of her reign, as it were, and her political demise. And she was always controversial. And her, even her death, and usually obituaries are a chance to look back with some distance and some elegance, perhaps, but has erupted in the media and indeed in Britain generally. I mean, she was a woman of vision, simple vision, that she wanted to strip socialism as she saw it out of Britain, and she combined that with a courage that we have to say wasn't reckless, and a political cunning. She knew when to go into battle swinging that handbag, that famous handbag. But she did change the face of Britain, from privatisations, destroying the power of union, fighting the Falklands War. But now, as people look back, I mean, as some people celebrate her for what she did, others are holding parties to celebrate her death. A policeman has been sacked for tweeting she died 1887 years too late. There's a campaign to get the Judy Garland song Ding Dong the Witch is Dead to number one. I think it's number two as we speak. So a hugely divisive figure, and again igniting those passions in Britain.
I think that, you know, there sometimes Margaret Thatcher's era is past, so there has been a time sort of to reflect on her legacy. And I think one of the most interesting commentaries has been that while she played an important role in breaking Britain from its past, in terms of the legacy of statism, the power of unions, etc., she did not do a great job of preparing Britain for its future. And that distinction between the past and the future is, I think, really critical to understanding the divided feelings about her rule now.
One of the things that I find really interesting in watching this is something more about the British people, which is the different way in which they hold their elected leaders, not in reverence the way that Americans hold their former elected leaders, but, you know, very much, you know, any man on the street can say anything they want about their elected leaders and feels free to do so. And I say this reflecting on the death of Ronald Reagan, who was an extremely divisive figure in his 8 years in power in the United States. And suddenly when he died, this hagiography took over, like he was the, you know, like he was this revered, beloved, bipartisan figure, which, you know, I can assure you, as can everyone who was alive during those years, he certainly was not beloved by both sides of the aisle. So I found that interesting, that the British and also particularly the Scottish did not feel it necessary to hold her in that regard. And, you know, there's some really interesting comments out there about how she destroyed her party's standing in Scotland, and she did more than any other single person to promote the eventual breakup of the UK because of that, the demise of British manufacturing and the destruction of skilled jobs came because of her, and that she promoted the sale of council homes, public housing, and created a current housing crisis and, you know, promoted depression. And I thought that was very interesting, that the British are able to have a debate about this in a way that the Americans never really had a debate about Reagan's legacy.
I mean, that struck me as well. I think it's absolutely true. And that sort of lack of deference, you could even say lack of gratitude, that the other great figure of the Prime Minister of the 20th century was Churchill. And of course, he was, after getting us through the Second World War, sacked by the electorate. Margaret Thatcher, having transformed not only her own party, but the Labour Party, virtually destroyed it at that stage, was sacked by her cabinet colleagues, who just had enough of her hectoring ways. And I think that the way that we look back on her now is different from even 5 years ago. I think, again, you made another important point, that one could have said, even people on the left would have said, well, she did some transformative things like privatisation that were 20 years ahead of the rest of Europe, getting rid of the state control of their industries. But now you think, getting rid of manufacturing, was that really so clever?
Yeah,
look
exactly.
At Germany, look at the United States. Yeah. Manufacturing's coming back, and it's a really important base.
And a question for you, Mark. Please discuss Margaret Thatcher's master handling of the media and her eponymous cult of personality.
And a very, yeah, intriguing the way she did it, I think, because she didn't go out to create an image. She didn't go to the polling groups and see what would go down well. But she created the image of a grocer's daughter from Grantham, what would be the equivalent, a store owner's daughter from Ohio, middle of the country, middle income. She, whilst a lot of her fans and supporters were actually very rich business people, she cultivated the sense that she was for the ordinary, hard-working man and woman who were just fed up with being bossed around by the government.
All right, let's take a caller on this very subject from Jeff in Charlotte, North Carolina. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. As a working-class lad from England and also working-class in 50 years in America, Margaret Thatcher was such a champion of free-market capitalism that she imported coal from communist Poland. She had ships built in communist Poland to destroy the British coal mining industry, to destroy the British shipbuilding industry, to destroy manufacturing and engineering in order to make London the financial center of Europe, which it is. But certainly the unions needed some kind of restrictions, but to destroy the entire industrial capacity of Britain was absolutely, in my opinion, completely insane.
Tom.
Well, Margaret Thatcher represented, in her rule, her governance, I think, represented a triumph of ideology over pragmatism and a more pragmatic approach to policymaking during her years would have seen that there are limitations, that there are drawbacks to totally free market, laissez-faire economics. And when we saw those in this country, that when you have free market forces completely unleashed, what you get is a financial crisis because there is no restraints on our financial institutions, and they do incredibly reckless things that are not in the public interest. And the same thing happened in London as a result of her approach to laissez-faire economics. And as I said before, she did not recognize that there is a role for the state in the management of the economy in the sort of the global world. And by being so hardline on a number of these issues, she really didn't prepare Britain for the challenges that it would be facing.
One comment to the listener who was asking about her management of the media, and you know, one reply to that is that she did not ever have the genial facade that Reagan had. And Reagan was able to, you know, break the air traffic controllers and do what he did always with a smile on his face. And she always had that sort of hectoring schoolmarm, you know, feeling about her. And also, it's not just the ideology. It's the ideology which, you know, sort of overtook everything. And I read one comment on the Guardian website, which I thought was really interesting, where one reader wrote in, "She was a friend of Pinochet and an enemy of Mandela. Enough said."
Indira Lakshman on Bloomberg News, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Gideon in Indianapolis. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Surely.
My question is, why did we go to Libya and not Syria?
Tom, do you want to take that on?
For the umpteenth time, Diane. You know, what the United States, what policymakers say, and it's not only with respect to Libya and Syria, is that that a country does not have to have absolute consistency. A country intervenes in defense of its interests as it defines them at the time. And it may, you know, apparently policymakers in the United States decided it was in the U.S. interest to intervene in Libya and not, at least in the beginning, in U.S. interest to intervene in Syria. So there is not a kind of a one-size-fits-all paradigm that any country will follow in implementing foreign policy.
I also think it's not just that. I think it's also about what they see as doable and what they can accomplish. And I think the White House saw Libya as, an overthrow of a government they could do, that they would succeed there. And from the very beginning, I think they've seen Syria as a much more intractable problem with huge regional spillover and implications for, you know, the rest of the region. And even though they would certainly like to see the regime go, I don't think they see it as clean an operation as Libya was in their view at the time.
And here's a question from Mike in Cincinnati. How does the North Korean nuclear issue define or affect U.S. foreign policy toward Iran and its nuclear program?
Well, at this moment, Iran looks like a relatively rational actor compared to North Korea. And, you know, given some of the statements that have come from Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, that's quite a statement. But I think that, there's two points here. One argument is that having allowed North Korea to get a nuclear weapon, having not intervened to block it when it had a chance, the United States could be accused of a double standard in not allowing Iran to sort of follow that example. On On the other hand, the other argument would be that we now see what happens when you allow a rogue state to develop a nuclear weapons capability, and that should give us some advice on how to deal with Iran.
So will South Korea now push for its own nuclear weapons?
Yes. It's certainly pushing for nuclear energy, and I think that's one of Kerry's purposes in the visit, is say, don't go down that path. And, of course, it's one of President Obama's strongest messages to the world, is that nuclear proliferation is something that has to be stopped. And this is what people fear about Iran getting hold of a weapon as well, that other people will want it, naturally, and that if you allow these states to get hold of them, other people will want them as well.
So if South Korea were to begin developing nuclear energy, what's that going to do between the North and the South?
Well, I mean, there already is an existing agreement between the U.S. and South Korea about civil nuclear cooperation, and what we're talking about is the renewal of that and certain strictures. I mean, the U.S., a couple of years ago, at the very end of Condoleezza Rice's time as Secretary of State, had inked a deal with the United Arab Emirates, a very sort of tough deal about civil nuclear cooperation, which involved that the UAE pledged to not do any of their own enrichment and only seek fuel from the outside. And what the Obama administration has tried to do is use that as a model for all civil nuclear cooperation going forward. But it's not, you know, that's easier said than done. And a lot of countries have said, look, we have a need to produce our own nuclear fuel. And so I think that this, you know, I think we do need to separate a civilian nuclear program from the question of a nuclear arms program. But as I mentioned earlier in the program, a recent poll shows that a majority of South Koreans now think that they should have a nuclear weapons program if North Korea continues to keep
this. Last word, Tom.
This is a very important issue to the South Koreans. They insist that they want to reprocess plutonium, not as part of a nuclear weapons program, but for their own purposes, but that plutonium could become a element in the manufacture of a weapon in the future.
Tom Jelton of NPR, Indira Lakshman on Bloomberg News, Mark Mardell of the BBC. Have a great weekend, everybody.
You too, Diane.
You too.
Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.